Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I'm sure in years to come, historians will look back on the last year and reflect on a period of enormous change in world power, with the so-called Arab Spring, the uprising in numbers of very significant Arab nations against authoritarian regimes. Many in the Western world hoped and prayed that this would herald a shift to freedom, democracy, peace in these often troubled nations. But a British author and former foreign correspondent says it's all been hijacked by dangerous extremists. John Bradley's new book, After the Arab Spring, suggests people are taking to the streets without an agenda which will leave nations like Egypt and Syria falling to Islamist extremists. John Bradley has witnessed this firsthand, and he joins us now to talk about this very timely issue on Open House. John, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time. John, take us through first your own professional and personal experience through this region.
Well, I moved to Egypt back in 1998. I just graduated, and I had no intention other than to learn Arabic, and that's what I did there for 18 months. 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, private tuition. And I lived with ordinary Egyptians in poor neighborhoods, so I didn't have any money. And I just, by default, fed into their own routine, using local transport, eating the food that they ate, and sharing their concerns and whatever was happening in their lives that particular day. I'm a political agnostic. I'm not ideologically driven, I just immersed myself in Egyptian culture for that period. Subsequently got a job in Saudi Arabia and lived there for 3 years. And between that time and now, I've lived in Yemen, Iran, Tunisia, and I was back in Egypt for many years. And the experience of Saudi Arabia culminated in a 2005 book called Saudi Arabia Exposed. And in 2008, I published a book on Egypt that had the subtitle The Land of the Pharaohs on the Brink of a Revolution, which not only predicted the Cairo uprising against Hosni Mubarak, but also in the final chapter very strongly suggested that though the Islamists wouldn't instigate a revolution, they would fill the vacuum subsequently, and that's precisely what's happened.
Which is your claim in this recent book. Before we go on to that, can I ask you about that initial move from the West into that region? What culturally struck you? What were the things that struck you most about such a cultural shift?
Well, remember, this was before 9/11. The main issue in the region in terms of geopolitics was the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But when I got to a country like Egypt, and especially Saudi Arabia, what struck me was that, although superficially quite westernized, I had to accept that they didn't necessarily want to be like us. And they in our lifetimes, they're not going to want to be like us. And this is something that I try to bring home very strongly in the new book, that there's this assumption in the West, and it's basically a kind of cultural imperialism, that we have got it all right, and that they merely want to mimic our perfect example. Now, first of all, we haven't got it all right. If you look at the economic situation on unemployment and crime rates and so on. And at the same time, we have a Judeo-Christian inheritance that is diametrically opposed to the Islamic inheritance that part of the world has. And so, for example, I didn't find that the concerns of the people, especially in Saudi Arabia, but in Egypt too, was that there was a lack of democracy. In fact, they would often, ordinary people, when you talked about democracy in the West and freedom in the West, would mock it, and albeit in rather silly terms sometimes, in the sense that they would say, the Jews controlled everything and other such nonsense. But that's what I came back to when these revolutions started to take place a year ago, that the assumption was that there was this great groundswell of opinion and this movement for freedom and pluralism and tolerance and democracy, whereas my experience of the previous decade suggested very strongly to me that this wasn't what it was all about at all.
on the streets, in the lives of ordinary people and away from the political parties and the political operatives, what were their aspirations? What are their aspirations?
Basically, the root cause of all these revolutions was economic. It started in Tunisia in the Deep South, the impoverished, neglected Deep South. And the biggest demonstration attracted just 50,000 people there of a population of about 10 million. And 80% of the population before the revolution, according to the World Bank, were part of the middle class. And so they shunned the revolution, despite the authoritarianism. In Syria, it started in a city in the south called Deraa, near the Jordanian border. And it had been experienced a drought, that region, for 3 years. It was purely economic. And an extensive opinion poll in Egypt after the after Mubarak fell found that only 19% of those who went to Tahrir Square actually did so because they were longing for free and fair elections and freedom of expression. 65% said it was the economy. Now, that brings me back to your specific question. Most people... the concern of most people I encountered, which is to say ordinary people, was that they had a job and that they could bring enough money back home in order to feed their families. That was first and foremost what their concern was. And when I published that book in 2008 on Egypt that predicted the revolution, I was so confidently able to do so because the economic situation in Egypt had deteriorated so much and there was no hope for reform, genuine economic reform that would address these core issues, that the revolution became inevitable. And so it's rather like Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore often points out, that if you provide the vast majority of the people with the basic necessities that they need to survive, and a good health system and an education system and safe streets and so on, they're not going to rebel, even if you're very authoritarian. And that's been my experience of the region.
So the revolution happens in the name of economics, and yet politically, and certainly how it's seen in the West, there are all these hopes for a democratic revolution. And yet you say the Islamists are filling the vacuum.
They are indeed. We've had 4 elections so far since the so-called Arab Spring erupted in Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco and Kuwait. Tunisia was the most secular, progressive, modern country in the history of the Islamic world before these revolutions started. The Islamists were given absolutely no role in politics whatsoever. They were either imprisoned or exiled, and yet they've taken over. They now run the parliament, and they've just announced that they're about to base a new constitution on Islamic law. In Morocco, they've taken control of the parliament for the first time in that traditionally tolerant country's history. In Egypt, they got 77% of the vote compared to just 2% for the party set up by the revolutionaries. And again, in Kuwait, it's the first time that the Islamists have taken over parliament. And while there were 4 female MPs in the previous Kuwaiti parliament, now there are none. And so the Islamists are filling the vacuum everywhere. And this is a real danger. There was this sense among many of the demonstrators before all of this erupted that a quick and very messy transition to Western-style democracy would resolve those core economic issues that plague these societies. But, of course, the very opposite has happened. All of the economies have tanked, and the region generally has lost perhaps $55 to $60 billion so far just in the past year. And this is a real danger now, that faith in the democratic process is being lost. We've spent most of the last year in Tunisia and Egypt, and the people are telling me that, oh, the parliament doesn't do anything, everything's got worse, we don't have any hope anymore. And this is all music to the ears of the Islamists, because the Islamists offer solace. And historically, they've managed to gain widespread support in these countries by providing charity work and mopping up the mess that the authoritarian regimes so liberally left behind them. And so the worse it gets, although they don't have a specific credible economic agenda, it puts the Islamists in a far stronger position, as does the horrible crime wave that broke out in all of these countries, especially Tunisia and Egypt, because the Islamists can then turn around and say, well, the only solution is Sharia law, strict interpretation of Sharia law in order to restore law and order. And these kind of simple slogans resonate very strongly among ordinary Arabs.
On Open House, we're with John Bradley, author of After the Arab Spring. John, in the West, there would certainly be a great fear of Islamist rule, and yet you use the word solace. That's what they are saying they offer these countries. How do you say these nations will change if the Islamist rule strengthens and strengthens?
Well, I say solace in a very abstract sense. Ordinary people will, if they've lost hope in everything else, then they turn back to more fundamental certainties and long-term certainties, and that means their faith. But in practical terms, day-to-day terms, the only people who actually have a great deal of faith in so-called moderate Islam are the people who have no stake. And so all of the apologists for groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and Ennahda in Tunisia, you'll find that if they're based in the region, they have foreign passports. They have British or American or European passports, or they're already based in the West. The real test for me over the past year was to ask ordinary Egyptians and Tunisians, which is to say members of the Christian minorities, liberal artists, unveiled Muslim women, these kind of people. And they are all terrified, of course, because they know the reality, which is to say that although superficially these Islamist groups promote a very liberal interpretation of Sharia law, this is just in order to gain power, they fear. And if you're a member, for example, of the Coptic Christian minority in Egypt, you only have to look at Iraq over the past 10 years to see what happens to religious minorities when Islamist, traditionally secular countries are taken over by Islamists. Now there are almost no Christians left in Iraq. There's been a massive increase in applications to the American and Canadian embassies, especially in Cairo, by members of the substantial Coptic Christian community in Egypt, because they're terrified that essentially Islamist law will mean Egypt becoming pretty much as Saudi Arabia is now.
So how do you judge the posture and the foreign policy of the West as this has unfolded, as so many hopes and prayers and dreams have been so dashed?
There are two bad players in all of this. The first is the media. The media got this completely wrong. A year ago, they got caught up in the euphoria of these demonstrations, and we saw them all kind of dancing and chanting along with the demonstrations in Tahrir Square in Cairo, for example, and they failed to see the bigger picture. Now, the only political party in town in the Middle East over the past 30 years or so has been political Islam. And it was inevitable that they were going to fill the vacuum, the Islamists, because the people who went out onto the street didn't have any experience of political participation and didn't have any political parties. Now, what's happened subsequently is the Islamists everywhere, as we said, have in fact filled the vacuum. And now the media is having to backtrack. But of course, no one wants to admit that they're wrong. And so we're still getting a dominant traditional Arab Spring narrative, but that will change. But in the meantime, it's been, as usual, pure hypocrisy from Washington. Now, Obama has given two of his lofty professorial lectures on the Middle East and democracy since the Arab Spring broke out a year ago. And on both occasions, he failed to mention Saudi Arabia. And in fact, during his first speech, the Saudi ambassador to Washington, Adela Jaber, was sitting in the front row, guest of honor. I can't see that a foreign policy in the Middle East that claims to have the promotion of human rights, free and fair elections, and freedom of expression at its core can at the same time overlook the fact that the most repressive and oppressive country in the region, and the one that has done most damage internationally as far as promoting radical jihadi Wahhabi style Islam is concerned, Saudi Arabia, gets off scot-free. It's just absurd. As usual, it's hypocrisy from Washington, and it's very superficial reporting from those who are covering the region.
John, it's important that we talk about Syria, especially on the back of the Libyan experience. Can I ask you this? Has the West morally, militarily failed the people of Syria who are opposed to Bashar al-Assad's regime?
Yeah, this has got nothing to do with the people of Syria, just as it had nothing to do with the people of Libya. Yes. And in fact, what we're about to see is an action replay in Syria of the debacle that took place in Libya. Now, Libya, of course, was a secular country under Colonel Gaddafi. It was a very prosperous country. repressive, certainly, and authoritarian. But Oxford University last week published a study that showed that only 16% of Libyans now are enthusiastic about the idea of free and fair elections and Western-style democracy. Some 60% said that they would prefer authoritarian rule. That's quite extraordinary. And when you look at Syria, it explains a great deal about why there has been no massive popular uprising there against Assad, authoritarian leader, but one who is secular and who protects the religious minorities and the ethnic minorities. You won't find any Christian or any member of any other religious minority in Syria who would say that they had suffered any kind of overt discrimination over the past 50-odd years of the Assad family's rule. Now, what we did in Libya was we went in and we armed jihadi fanatics, many of whom were open about the fact that they had fought as members of al-Qaeda against American troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. And yet we armed them, we funded them, we trained them, and the media portrayed them as freedom fighters. Now look what's happened in Tripoli. The militias now rule. Sharia law has been imposed. And the country is fast on the way to becoming yet another Wahhabi backwater. Now, if our concern principally is geopolitics and doing Washington's bidding, then of course that sounds like not such a bad idea. But if our concern, and what I try to highlight in my books, is the consequences on all of this on ordinary people, then this is of course a catastrophe, because what we'll see in Syria is very, very much what we saw in Iraq too, which is to say, 5 years from now, if this so-called rebellion succeeds, there will be no Christians left in Syria. I guarantee you that they'll either be slaughtered or they'll flee into exile. We really should be very careful about what we wish for when it comes to Syria, and hope that diplomatic initiatives, although they're not very exciting and they don't generate exciting headlines, take precedence and also ultimately prevail.
John, how do you believe historians will look back in years to come on this particular period of world history?
That the Arab Spring, in terms of how it was initially portrayed, was a catastrophe, that it didn't result in freer societies, it didn't result in more pluralistic societies, more tolerant societies. But what happened is that Islam has filled the vacuum, and 5 to 10 years from now, when we're looking back, all those who celebrated this Arab Spring as something wonderful and progressive will be scratching their heads as they look around and see, from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, the entire swath of North Africa ruled by Islamist theocracies. The Persian Gulf, of course, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, and so on, are already Islamist theocracies. Egypt is on its way to becoming a hardcore Islamist theocracy. And the only Arab secular regime left, Syria, will have fallen to the Islamists too. And so, yes, people will be asking, how on earth did a wave of popular uprisings, supposedly in the name of Western ideals, how did it turn into such an Islamist nightmare?
John Bradley, it's an important conversation about a very significant period of world history, and we must say a great cause for prayer for the future. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
Entirely my pleasure. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.